Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky, and I am deeply sorry for the off-the-cuff comments I made during previous episodes of Remainiacs. I do not believe that the real divide in our society is between people who voted to remain or to leave the EU. The real divide is between the many and the few. Down with Tory Brexit, up with magic Brexit, my captors are treating me well. That's my tribute to Andrew Adonis and his bizarro Facebook statement last week, which we'll talk about a little bit about later. Fortunately, Seamus doesn't have the key code for the Remainiac studio, so we're safe. With me are two of our emphatically anti-Brexit regulars. Naomi Smith is the interim CEO of Best for Britain, but she's still here in personal capacity. Hi, Naomi, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. How are you?
All right. We're going to talk about this a lot later, but what's the state of play from your point of view in the EU elections right now? Is there any hope of a united Remain front?
I think it's very unlikely. It's a big shame. I don't know if you saw Hope Not Hate and YouGov did a great poll that was out at the start of this week. And basically, it just showed that if between them, Greens, Lib Dems and Change UK would be prepared to stand down in one region, just one of the three standing down in each region and dividing up between them, then it would almost double the number of MEPs that they would get elected from 9 to 16. Mm. However, I think at this stage it is highly unlikely. Talks are continuing. There is still work being done behind the scenes to try and convince the leaders of those groups to do that. But I think we shouldn't expect it to happen, and that if it does, it'll be a nice surprise.
And we haven't talked enough about the elections that are definitely happening this week, the local elections. What bearing are they likely to have on Brexit?
I think they're likely to have a bearing on the ever-sharpening knife being wielded for Theresa May. I'm told that senior Conservatives have been drawn into Number 10 this week to help start drafting her final speech. I don't know if that's just so that they can be prepared and have one ready, or whether, you know, there is any kind of planned step down, Let's all be careful what we wish for at this stage. So I think it'll certainly help bolster those in the Conservative Party looking to get rid of Theresa May.
Maybe Andrea Adonis can make her final speech.
That's Alex Andreou, columnist, actor, cook, singer and much, much more. It's been quite a good week for Europhiles that aren't in Britain. Kantar polled the entire EU and found that every country but here was over 80% pro-Remain, and even the lowest score, Italy 72%, looked quite enviable from this side of the channel.
Yeah.
Does this make Britain a cautionary tale for the rest of the EU?
I think Brexit has been a terrific tonic for pro-European politics, that's for sure. I can see that even in myself, in that where I've previously taken it as a given and, you know, was a bit meh about it, it was only since Brexit that I started to more consciously think of what the EU actually offers to us. So I'm sure people for whom Frexit or Grexit or Dexit or whatever exit
Chexit
was Chexit was a sort of nice fantasy before can now look at the reality of the constitutional mess that involves and maybe say no thanks, not for us.
Later on, Alex will be treating us all to the winner of our Donald Tusk Romantic Fiction Prize, where we ask listeners to channel their intense feelings about the President of the European Council.
Romantic fiction. It's smut.
Raising the tone is this week's special guest, Rachel Shabby, writer of The Guardian and The Nation, broadcaster, expert on the Middle East conflict, author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands, and a big fan of the People's Vote. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hello. There was really only one way up from Thanks for that.
I set them up, you knock them out.
Yeah.
There's obviously quite a lot that Labour would like to be doing and would like to be talking about. It was quite nice hearing Rebecca Long-Bailey on the Today programme, who I can't bear when she's talking about Brexit, but talking about climate change. And it was like, oh, yes, you know, these are really good ideas and there's a lot to be done. How much is the Brexit issue and obviously the tensions within the party, within members and voters, sort of getting in the way of that, sort of stalling the project at the moment?
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention climate change. And of course, the Labour Party is trying to declare an emergency climate change situation today, which is the call that came, you know, partly from Extinction Rebellion protests that we saw over the Easter bank holiday weekend. And that was you know, it was quite an incredible thing to have 4 days of, firstly, not Brexit, and secondly, something that was actually more engaging and more urgent in many ways, except for, you know, in terms of a parliamentary calendar, but certainly more urgent globally than Brexit. So it's like this little glimmer of some of the things we could be talking about and how we could be talking about them and how we could be mobilising support for them. And I think for the Labour Party, that's been the constant frustration with Brexit, is that it would like to go around it, right? Because there's so many other things that it wants to be focusing on. And ultimately, you know, I think there is a consensus somehow in the Labour Party that Brexit or stopping Brexit is one thing, but actually the real healing or the real benefit to the country will be stopping the causes of Brexit. So stopping that sort of rampant inequality that we've got in this country that's the worst in Europe, you know, stopping the sort of wage stagnation and the homelessness and the food bank dependency and all the things that are affecting most people in a really significant way across the country, some of which fueled Brexit. I think there's a recognition of the Labour Party that it would much rather be dealing with that than with Brexit itself. But increasingly in the party, you're seeing a split between people who are saying, let's try and just nudge and fudge away around Brexit, and people, and this is in the radical left, and people saying, also in the radical left, saying, well, that would be ideal, but we left that exit on the motorway several months ago, and we now actually have to go through Brexit. We have to engage with it and essentially pick a side.
So this reminded me of going on a bear hunt where you can't go under, you know, the children's book where he goes, you can't go under it, you can't go around it, you have to go through it.
Can I just say that for European migrants like me, Brexit is not a separate issue from poverty and homelessness.
Sure.
Or climate change. And so this is an aspect of the Labour rhetoric that I found really particularly grating. You know, this idea that, you know, ignore Brexit because then we can get on with helping the NHS and helping poorly people and helping homeless people. Well, what about Bulgarian homeless people? What about, you know, German people who are sick? How are you helping them by piling this massive thing on top of their already difficult life? So just wanted to put that in brackets there.
Repping for the EU 27.
Yeah, sorry.
It's all right. Well, we'll be talking more about all of this, as well as the British economy's unfolding new role as a petri dish for a world after global cooperation, after this quick reminder from Naomi.
Tickets for the next Romaniacs Live in London are disappearing faster than ingenious alternative arrangements for the border in Ireland. We're doing an Eve of the EU Elections Crisis special on Tuesday, May the 21st at the Leicester Square Theatre. And our special guest is comedian, broadcaster and friend of the show, Marcus Brigstock. Dorian, Ian Dunt and I will be on the panel for the night, and we're going to see if we can persuade Marcus to answer a few questions in the style of his amiable nitwit, Giles Wembley-Hogg, who may well be leading the Conservative Party by the time we record the show. Also, it's a double special event because we're marking the launch of Dorian's new book, The Ministry of Truth, a biography of George Orwell's 1984. Copies will be on sale and Dorian signing them too. Tickets are on sale now at leicestersquaretheatre.com. If you're a Patreon backer, check your inboxes for your discount code and we'll see you there and then. That's Romaniacs Live at the Leicester Square Theatre on Tuesday, 21st of May, right before Europe goes to the polls. Tickets at leicestersquaretheatre.com.
Thanks, Naomi. Let's start with the EU elections and specifically the row over a confirmatory referendum on the Labour manifesto. After a week of rancorous to and fro, the NEC finally agreed on Tuesday to the old formulation of a referendum under some circumstances, falling short of what Tom Watson and much of the membership wanted. If you were following the reaction within the PLP, it wasn't much help. Wes Streeting spun it as a welcome commitment to a referendum. Gloria De Piero said it was a welcome refusal to commit to a referendum. And Bridget Phillipson called the wording mealy-mouthed and the bare minimum, saying it would demoralise activists and depress turnout. Now, it doesn't, because it is, in a sense, a restatement of the conference motion, it doesn't change a great deal, but the timing and the optics, because this is the manifesto for the European elections, has made it the last straw for a lot of people, including at least one person in this room. Alex, was this expected?
Yes. I mean, yeah, it was expected. The issues, the issue that has plagued the Conservative Party as well, which is if you promise to leave with no downsides, and it is actually impossible to leave with no downsides, but it's also politically impossible to remain, then what you end up is in a situation where you're perpetually leaving. And that's where we've ended up. But it was disappointing. It was disappointing because there had been such clear instructions from CLPs, from over 100 MPs, from all the MEPs, from Scottish Labour, from Welsh Labour. And to say that the situation is a restatement, therefore there's no change, I think is deceitful. Because actually, to restate the same position 2 years down the line when you've run out of road is a change of position. You know, to say we're now at the edge of the cliff and we're still going to dither is not the same thing as saying I'm going to dither when you're 5 miles from the cliff.
We had 16,000 emails sent to NEC members from Best for Britain supporters who are also Labour voters and Labour supporters. They've told us that they are trying to persuade them ahead of yesterday's meeting of the NEC. And since that meeting, Remainers have been so angry about it, and I understand and share their frustration no end. But they seem to be thinking, all right, well, that's it. There is literally no point in lobbying Labour now on this anymore. Just give up and focus our attentions elsewhere. But I do think that we need to remind people that it's that support over the last year that has made a difference. I know it doesn't feel like it, but it has, because Brexit is still now down to MPs. It is still there. It's still for them to make that difference. And this isn't about whether or not you're going to vote Labour, but it is about making sure that you do keep applying that pressure. I think even a month ago, we may not have been in a position where we would have been able to say for 100% certain that the manifesto would have included the policy commitment from last year's conference in the September.
A month ago, we expected to be out of the EU.
Exactly, so, exactly. And you know. And they did whip for the indicative votes for a people's vote twice. And I think that is all down to that constant drumbeat from its members and supporters, reminding them, if we take our foot off the pedal of Labour now, then they have free run. So this isn't about telling people to vote for Labour, but I do think we need to keep the pressure up on them. Now is not the time to pull back from it.
I heard someone make a very interesting point where they were suggesting we're in this weird catch-22 situation, because if Parliament approves May's deal, then May doesn't need Labour in any way or a confirmatory vote. And if Parliament doesn't approve May's deal, then the condition under which Labour will call for a confirmatory vote will never be met. And so,
yeah, because then it wouldn't be Tory Brexit.
Exactly. Mm, yeah. So either way, you never get a confirmatory vote. Mm. I mean, you could look at it entirely the opposite way around. Mm. You could say, actually, since no deal and Tory Brexit are already sort of dying options, we will eventually get to a confirmatory vote. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right, what you're saying about maintaining the pressure. I do think there has been a journey that the Labour leadership has been on. And sometimes, you know, it replicates the journey that individuals, Labour Party members or supporters have also been on. Mm. I don't think this is an ideological thing. So when we're talking about the radical left, I think there's several strands in it. And there is a strand that is quite Lexity, in a sort of
God the L word.
In a sort of old left way, and old here is not an age descriptor, mm-hmm. right? It's a temperament descriptor.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the more significant split is really about tactics and strategy. And it's over the idea of having a second referendum at all, as to whether or not that's a good idea. And, you know, there'll be people inside that configuration who will say, well, it might not be a good idea, but it's really the only option that we have available at this stage. Yeah. You know, we've run out of road. This is all we can do. It's going to be nasty. Of course it is. No one relishes it. But show me the other option. And then there'll be a strain of people who will say, no, that's not a right thing to do, because we told people that, you know, that the referendum decision would be enacted, and now telling them that it won't be enacted is going to be even worse than enacting some...
The sort of Lisa Nandy school.
Right, right. Which, you know, I find that slightly... I think you can make the case that a second referendum is strategically or tactically a bad idea, but I'm a bit worried about, you know, the main progressive party in the UK saying that it's undemocratic. I don't think that's a useful narrative for progressives to get into. I think it's feeding a frame that is populist right. Mm-hmm. So I would much prefer it if progressives didn't use that kind of landscape and terminology. But then there's the third element, and this is all the sort of, you know, Corbyn supporting left, the radical left, the third element that would say, well, if there is a second referendum, it will empower the sort of the nativist far right. And the second bit of that sentence, which is not often explored, is, and we do not trust progressives to have an argument in response to that. And you can understand why they're saying that, because when you look at things like People's Vote, and you look at the ambassadors of People's Vote, we have people like Tony Blair, who only a few weeks ago was saying, you know, it's migrants have failed to integrate. Mm. You know, so we have that on the one side. And then we have on the other side the kind of blue Labour component that for decades now has been feeding an anti-migrant narrative and has been quite willing to throw them under the bus when required. And then even on the radical left, we have these kind of... I don't know, people who argue from the left that, you know, this is all essentially some ruse concocted by liberals and migrants to overwhelm the wishes of the working class, and the working class are always, in this context, white.
Yes.
Yeah. Right?
White, so male.
White, male, and static.
English.
Static.
English. English.
And English, and very static.
Incels, usually.
So when you look at that, you can understand why there's an element of the sort of the Labour, you know, the composite that will say, we don't trust the left to handle a second vote. Mm-hmm.
But that's an argument that I don't think People's
Vote is really engaged with in a serious way.
And I think, but I think what happened yesterday has helped Farage. I think the NEC decision has emboldened Farage. And when we look back at history, any time that, well, we know what happens when the far left do things that embolden the far right. And so I don't, you know, while I understand a lot of that analysis, I don't agree with the prescription being to continue to have this fudge position. I know you don't either. I just...
No, indeed. The whole, you know, love socialism, hate Brexit affiliation of MPs is very much from that perspective. And I think
Most of them aren't white.
And most of them aren't white.
To me, the crux of it, which is why today I've come out for the Greens, actually, just because in my area it makes sense. But the crux of it is this, that all of these theories, all of these electoral strategies are based on the notion that you can kick the Remain progressive side of the Labour Party a lot more before they leave you than you can kick.
They're much softer than the Leave vote for
Labour,
which is the hard
blank. And actually, that's why I think we now need to show that. I think the only thing that is capable of saving the Labour Party from itself at this moment is to show them that actually the progressive vote and the Remain vote is also mobile and is also capable of saying, you're not expressing my wishes.
There was a populist poll out this morning on exactly this, which is quite interesting, showing that Labour is getting the worst of all worlds with their Brexit policy. Mm. 61% of Leave voters think Labour is anti-Brexit, only 7% think they're pro-Brexit, and 28% of Remain voters think Labour is anti-Brexit. So in other words, Labour's policy of fence sitting is just really pissing off both sides.
Yeah,
and I think that, I mean, to your point, I think that that is true about Labour Remain voters, and that's something that, you know, when you look at even polling that TSSA has done, which is, you know, a very Corbyn-supporting union, and they did some work a few months ago, and they found exactly that. They said, look, you're more likely to antagonise your Remain voters. Labour Leave voters are shifting more to Remain, number one, and number two, it's not as important to Labour leavers as it is to...
And the really hard leavers have kind of left you anyway. Because actually, you can't be making a pitch to the really hard leavers and at the same time saying that Churchill was a traitor. Mm. You know, it's the sort of thing that will rile them up anyway. Because you have to be... If you're going to court that vote, you have to court it wholeheartedly. You have to make a sort of motherhood and apple pie argument to that core vote.
Well, because they have all these other cultural values.
Exactly.
It's not just
about...
So you can't be saying,
I'm not sure about Churchill and I don't know about Trident, and at the same time be trying to court them with a Brexit vote, because you don't come off as authentic. They won't believe you.
So, but to the thing about Remainers registering their discontent with Labour and showing that they... You know, they shouldn't be taken for granted, or that, which I think is what's been happening. You know, Labour said, well, we can essentially absorb a hit slightly from that flank, but not from the Leave flank. So I think I understand that sentiment. And I also understand the impulse of saying, well, why should I have my vote then aggregated as a pro-Brexit vote when Parliament says, well, the two... But in the European context, I would really caution against that, because you will be doing a disservice to the European Parliament, which is facing a threat from the far right. So, you know, if we split the progressive vote, the risk of returning, you know, Brexit and UKIP MPs to Europe, and therefore having the European Parliament, which is already facing the far right in other permutations in other countries, having to deal with that number of far right MPs as well, I don't think that's an act of international socialism. By the way, I don't think Labour's approach is an act
of international socialism either. But I agree, but that only becomes relevant if we don't Brexit. If both Labour and the Conservatives are pushing for Brexit, then the MEPs we send for a maximum of a couple of months is neither here nor there, in my view. And the only way to make Labour change their position on Brexit and stop it is to kick them. And well, this is the only chance I get to kick them.
I've come round to the same position after yesterday. I understand in general election, you know, there's lots of other factors. You need to get Tories out as paramount. This is a Europe-focused election with an electoral system that, relative to first-past-the-post, benefits smaller parties. There are plenty of firmly anti-Brexit parties that deserve your vote. And I do think if you, stroke I, can't back them on this occasion, then I don't know when you ever will. I also think there is a factor that our sort of favourite Labour candidates, people like Seb Dance, Claude Moraes, Eloise Todd, are quite near the top of the list. So I do imagine that a lot of the kind of these ardent Remainers that have signed this pledge to campaign for another referendum would likely get in anyway. It's not like their vote's completely going to collapse. Further down the list, to be honest, I would rather see greater plurality. I would rather see the smaller parties rewarded for taking a firm stand. And as you said, Rachel, the had the experience in 2017 of having my vote spun as an endorsement of Brexit. And it's infuriating that 80% of people voted for parties that supported Brexit.
Including by members of the Shadow Front Bench.
And it's just driven me mad. And I think it would be crazy for Remainers, depending on the electoral map, if you're in a constituency where basically nobody but Labour has a chance, okay, fine. But if you're in a constituency, which is London is one, where other parties have a chance, Gavin Esler, for example, has a strong chance, or in the southwest, you know, Molly Scott, Cato. I just don't know why you wouldn't vote for a pro-Remain party on this occasion.
Well, yeah, I don't buy that argument. I mean, I think when we get closer and closer to the election, it will become. A two-party race in the loose sense that it will be about Brexit parties on one side and the Brexit party on one side and the progressives on the other. And I think that in a European context, by the way, I don't think the Labour position now is particularly international socialism either, because they're not engaging with that reality of how do we get the European Parliament to shift leftwards? And it's quite odd to me that, you know, the radical left that envisages radical transformative change that this country needs, you know, socioeconomic transformation in this country, then sees the EU as something that's quite static and, you know, permanently neoliberal. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, but you can change that.
Yeah.
You know, if the PES, the Party of European Socialists, were a majority and in that parliament, that doesn't happen with Greens and that doesn't happen with Change UK. If they were in the majority, then they could shift the European Parliament leadership and the entire configuration would tack to the left. So if you believe in that, and therefore you believe in progressive values around climate change, around austerity, around taxing, fairer taxation, if you believe
I agree with all of that. I simply don't see Labour as a particularly progressive party.
That's the best counter-argument that I've heard. I mean, I'm still not voting Labour this time. Okay. I just can't. But I do think that that's definitely the kind of strongest response I've heard.
Why? So, best written, we've done tactical voting things before. I haven't yet decided whether or not we're going to do one this time. It's a conversation I'll have to have with colleagues. But one thing that makes it so difficult is knowing how to not do harm, because mm-hmm. I totally buy it. You know, I'm a Liberal Democrat. I am not going to be voting Labour in these elections. But when you look at certain regions, and yesterday I was playing around, I sent it to Alex, a Dehaene calculator based on a 17th of April poll with those numbers, and it put Labour on 35% in London. When you take that down to 25% and you split it across Greens and Lib Dems, you're only getting one more Brexit Party MEP elected. You're not guessing. So I guess I understand. I do. I just think we have to be so careful. That's not me advocating how anyone should vote at all. But I think as the polls solidify, European polls are notoriously inaccurate, especially this far out. So I think we are probably all just going to have to take a judgment call the week
I think
before.
The thing too is just going to have to pay very close attention to decide how best to use your vote in your part of the country. There's just one thing I wanted to mention before we moved on, is that Jeremy Hunt the other day during an interview called the question of a second referendum the central argument in British politics, which, given what it was a year ago, given what a kind of long shot it seemed, you know, before People's Vote launched, I do think that's quite a remarkable achievement that so much of the conversation is gravitating towards that. And that's the only time I will quote Jeremy Hunt.
And it is improving. And it is important to keep positive, because actually the thing that can hurt Remain is low turnout. And what we need to do is drive registration, drive Remainers to go and vote. That's the most important thing. They can choose Labour if they agree with your argument. They can choose someone else if they don't. But it will be decided on turnout.
Vote, vote, vote. Now, watch out. It's the future of the British economy. Whatever happens with Brexit, it's already changing, and some are seeing it as a giant experiment in what happens to developed economies in a post-global world. Trade barriers are going up, uncertainty is being destroyed, Donald Trump is using trade wars as a domestic political tool. According to Bloomberg, Britain and Europe are an experiment, I think Britain's relationship to Europe, I mean, there is an experiment in undoing globalisation. Mm-hmm. Mark Carney says, excitingly, we are the acid test of the new way of doing things. Rachel, what globalization is like, it means different things to different people. And obviously, on the left, it is often synonymous with neoliberalism. But then there's also kind of there's a sort of an internationalism aspect to it as well. Is it possible to, do you think that globalization generally has been pernicious? Do you think there's a way of sort of untangling it from the pernicious aspects?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that it's associated with capitalism on the left, because, you know, I remember covering actually the anti-capitalist protests of the late 90s and early 2000s. So that was very much anti-capitalist. They were called anti-capitalist protests, and it was, you know, Global South led in the sense that they had been the initial recipients of essentially austerity programs that were then called structural adjustment programs. So they were, you know, Western economies going into global south economies and saying, well, we'll give you loans, but you have to make your markets accessible to us. You have to shrink the welfare state. You have to shrink the state. And, you know, it paralyzed economies and communities in all kinds of different ways. And at that time, you know, the media started to call those protests anti-globalization.
Yeah,
at which point a bunch of people said, but we're not. Like, that's not what this is. This is anti-capitalist. Like, don't depoliticize this or repackage it in a way that makes it easy for you to comprehend, because that's not what's going on here. So I think there's always been that understanding, and therefore, and that anti-capitalism has had, you know, since then various iterations, but it has been in some way a rejection of a neoliberal economic model over which there's been a consensus in the West, in, you know, in Europe, in the US for several decades, and, you know, the radical left analysis of that, the Corbyn left leadership analysis of that would be that has caused extreme economic inequality and extreme economic punishment in our societies, avoidably, for ideological reasons.
And has failed by its own standards.
Absolutely.
You know, when
Absolutely.
You're having to bail out banks.
Right,
exactly. I mean, that's it. Yeah. You know, it's failed.
And we failed to not stop internationalism becoming equated with inequality.
Yeah.
And this is all about the growing inequality, galloping growing inequality in most Western democracies now. And we just shouldn't be surprised when globalization isn't working for people, that those people say, hey, globalization isn't working for me. You know, it shouldn't be an effing surprise.
But if we say globalization, then that's conceding a bit of the argument that says we shouldn't be joined up, we shouldn't have free movement of people. It's capitalism that's not working. It's not the fact that we're interconnected and people migrate.
And we've not made that case.
And we've not made that case.
Yeah.
We agree.
Completely.
It's all over. We agree. Because, I mean, the right has lots of responses to globalisation, you know, protectionism and trade wars and you know, anti-immigrant sentiment. What's the sort of left's alternative then? What's the left's kind of strongest argument for a form of kind of interconnectedness that that is not what we currently have?
Well, I mean, if you ask me, I would say international socialism, internationalist socialism. You know, the whole, when you crunch down into Labour's 2017 manifesto, and you're seeing iterations of that amongst equivalent lefts across Europe, but also in the US, with the new Democrats coming up as well. When you look at that, and you look at the meat and bones of the policy, what is going on is a rewiring of the economy. It is a transformation. It is a socioeconomic change, and it's about regrowing the economy. And doing it in a way that is green and community-driven and regionalised rather than nationalised. And I think the challenge for the left in the UK, and especially in this sort of Brexit environment that we're in, is to find a style and a language that has not managed to do, that actually joins that up to the, you know, culture war, for want of a better word, that we're in. Yeah. And to find a language that includes migrants and is anti-racist in that iteration, as well as having that socioeconomic, like joining the dots and saying this all comes together or it doesn't work at all.
We have to redistribute the proceeds of growth, and we've got two governments that should be helping us do it, both the UK one and our European one. And actually, our European one has been doing it for us a lot of the time. When we look at
to an extent.
But you know, when we think about areas of the UK that are amongst the most deprived areas in Northern Europe, there are EU-funded projects happening there that our UK government wasn't and wouldn't fund.
Because they're not marginal.
But wealth has been so concentrated in the hands of the few that until we, as a centre-left, socialist-left, progressive-left, whatever kind of word you want to use for it, distribute that wealth both geographically and amongst people of different income brackets, we're not going to win, and there is a role for an active state in that and for an active EU in doing that, and the EU has been doing that. And when you go to, I don't know whether it's because we're a net contributor, but when you are anywhere else in the EU and you walk past a park, a playground, a building that has been funded,
there's a thing,
there's this enormous fucking thing on the hoardings around it, and on ours you've got to squint and like really get magnifying glass out to see one tiny little tile in the top left-hand corner saying this was funded by
To me, the connected issue, which has been a failure on actually all sides, is the lack of realisation that European politics, global politics, but European politics is at the moment a fairly accurate reflection of the sort of average of our national politics. You know, the reason the EU has gone more neoliberal, more monetarist, is because it is an accurate reflection of its constituent members' politics, which is an accurate reflection of our regional and local politics and our personal politics. And you cannot wave a magic wand and do away with one layer of administration, hoping that this will magically leave the rest, and the rest will be a socialist utopia. I mean, in the case of the UK, it's historically illiterate. The EU has anchored the UK towards the centre, if anything, has prevented it from spinning further to the right the majority of the time. All its policies...
And you could ask, the reverse is true, that the UK has dragged the EU to the right.
Absolutely. In the case of Greece, you know, my home country, I understand the argument a lot better, because Greece wants to go slightly more to the left and the EU is not letting it. Mm. But the idea that somehow the EU is preventing the UK from becoming socialist is for the birds. Historically, that's not what has happened. You know, workers' protection legislation, environmental legislation, consumer protections, all those things, the EU has consistently been to the left of UK government policy.
But that is the argument
That's just the fact.
No, I'm not disagreeing. I'm just going to expand on that a little bit and say, you know, this is something that actually Laura Parker recently wrote. She's one of the Labour MEP candidates. Yeah. She's a momentum organiser.
Number four, I think.
Guardian piece.
London list, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So she joined those dots in terms of... you know, the capacity to deal with those big issues like climate change and austerity, but also take on, you know, the far right in a European context and help our European progressive allies in that fight. But also this idea, even if that were true, it doesn't work on its own terms. Even if you thought that the EU was a construct preventing a socialist radical agenda in the UK, so if you had a Corbyn-led Labour Party, and it would be constrained by the EU, even if that were true, which it is not, then why wouldn't you want the European Parliament to tack leftwards, so that when you as the Labour Party, in whatever relationship you're in with the EU,
exactly,
when you approach the EU, you already have, you know,
exactly,
ideological partners in the frame.
Yeah.
So even on its own terms, that argument about the EU being intractably neoliberal doesn't, and a bar to socialism doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but it's all about instant solutions, because the idea that I have to change profoundly my personal politics in order to change my local politics, in order to change our national politics, in order to affect European politics, is a lot of bloody hard work. So ticking a box and saying, if I tick this box, everything will be okay, is the much easier option. So of course it's attractive.
Well, thinking globally, this phrase is the economy stupid, which dates back to the 92 Clinton campaign. Sort of worked as a truism of electoral politics for quite a long time. And I think it certainly seemed to be, from reading about the 2016 referendum campaign, that seemed to be what sort of Craig Oliver was working on. It's just like, just hit them with the economic arguments. Didn't work. Didn't work in the Trump-Clinton election. Does this mark a kind of a long-term shift towards culture wars and identity and away from economic arguments? Because that, if that's the kind of near future, then people are going to take quite a while to work out how to deal with that, because this is something that they just believed in for decades.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and that is the danger of the you know, the moment that we're in, where these culture wars aren't just about values, although they really are in a big way about values, about what you stand for, but they're also about, it's not changing the facts, it's creating confusion over facts, so people no longer know what to believe. So that when, you know, Michael Gove says, you know, we've had enough of experts, that, you know, when when you describe the judges, the judiciary as enemies of the people, you are undermining...
When you say fuck business.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, no, not so much that. But these are institutions
if you're conservative, I think it
that does matter. Where there is an element of trust and truth. And if you undermine the capacity to believe that there is an objective truth, then you're in trouble. Because then nobody will believe you, and it doesn't matter how much factually you say things, nobody will believe it's true.
But do you think it's you didn't believe the economic warnings? Because there seemed to be quite a lot of polling which suggested that a significant number of people did believe them,
but didn't care.
And I think maybe that was where there was a sort of break with consensus of how we've kind of run campaigns for so many years, was that people would actually go, I am willing to be poorer to leave Europe, keep immigrants out, etc.
But I think a lot of people believe how much worse could my life get, actually. A lot of people feel that things are so bad for them that your economic warnings mean nothing because actually they couldn't get any worse. It's wrong, actually.
Yeah, but there's also
they could get a whole lot worse.
But there's also plenty of comfortably off people that feel that way as well. So let's not do
Absolutely.
You know,
but the point is, if you dismantle our tools for conflict resolution, then it's impossible to find compromise. Impossible. Because if your argument is X on economics and mine is Y on economics, we may be able to find compromise as long as we can refer to some facts that are objective. But if your argument is fuck facts, facts are for sissies, then we can never agree. We can never find compromise.
Which was the goal. Which was the goal of that kind of politics. Well, but as a counter to that... one of the things that happened, you know, so Ipsos just did a poll a few months ago about national attitudes to immigration, and it's been, there are more people who are positive than negative about immigration. Yeah. It's been a big change.
Yeah, big change.
And so one of the things, when they said, what is it that persuaded you most to change? The answer that more people said than not was, oh, there's more awareness of the positive benefits of immigration, which is encouraging, but also heartbreaking, because the bit of you thinks that that's
why didn't
took.
We make this
only
argument
only we
before.
Made that case, which implies that people aren't resistant to arguments.
Well, if you're into objective truth, there's a book coming out at the end of May, which is all over that shit.
Who's that by again?
Just some bald
guy.
Bald guy that's obsessed with Brexit.
Some guy.
Now, a special instalment of what we like to call Romaniacs After Dark.
Oh, God.
Pour yourself a glass of wine, send the kids out of the room, and turn the lights down low.
God, can I leave now?
It's Alex Andreu in his dressing gown. A couple of weeks ago,
he's not in his dressing gown. I wouldn't have lasted this long.
This is the magic of radio. A couple of weeks ago, we announced the Romaniacs Donald Tusk Romantic Fiction Prize as a way for listeners to channel their appreciation of the European Council's rugged yet sensitive president, especially a photo of him as a student. We were looking.
This is actually worse than your views on Labour, can I just say?
We were looking for imagination and quality prose style. The winner gets a personalised I Heart Tusk t-shirt and mug, plus Alex reading out their work on the show. It aroused a lot of interest.
Oh.
Alex, who is the lucky winner?
The winner is Phil Dore. We got a surprising number of rubbish entries, and they were surprisingly rubbish. This was
them.
The least rubbish one, just. Julia Hartley Brewer crept down the hallway towards Donald Tusk's office. She wasn't sure what had caused her to take the Eurostar to Brussels. Possibly it had been the photo of him as a young man at that process. She knew she despised the man, but something about that photo made her melt like a liberal snowflake at a Jordan Peterson lecture. His office door was ajar, and she got a glimpse of him. True, he was much older now, but he had aged well. Like the fine English sparkling wine she had sipped at the St. Pancras Wetherspoons earlier. He looked up. Miss Hartley Brewer, he smiled. What brings you here? I heard about your solidarity, she stammered. Isn't that communist talk? I do hope you won't try to seize control of my means of production. Not in the least, he smiled. I believe in universal rights and freedoms. That's a shame, she whispered. I'd heard something about from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. You have needs, he replied coyly. No. Maybe they can be met with a long extension. Have you ever thought about an ever closer union?
Is it over?
It's over.
Come out.
Oh, never coming on again.
You don't know how unlucky you are that the stars aligned in such a way.
I'm so blessed. Hashtag.
Pray for Shabby.
Our very tolerant and regretful guest this week is writer for The Guardian and broadcaster Rachel Shabby. Rachel, thanks for coming in. The concern, I suppose, about averting Brexit one way or another that some people have voiced, you alluded to this earlier, is that it sort of gives the far right the kind of stab in the back myth that the far right so dearly loves. But do you think that Farage's whole sort of political project is grievance and betrayal, and that this sort of the movement around him would find some form one way or another? That it couldn't be sort of... You can't just sort of put it back in the bottle. There's no version of Brexit which would just kind of drain that poison.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent that is true. You can't put Brexit back in the bottle, right? It's out there. And now there are only horrible solutions. So the question is, which is the least horrible and the least damaging? And that's where the disagreement is, isn't it? For the Labour left, certainly, of... You know, do we face down the far right? Is Brexit and, by extension, the European elections, are they all a carrier for the culture war that we're in? Is it like the British iteration of a global culture war between, you know, the progressive left and the far right? Or is there a way to extract that fight from Brexit itself? And I think that's been, you know, certainly amongst the Corbyn left, that's been the disagreement. But what's interesting to me is that you see more and more of the Corbyn supporting left go into the camp that says, no, actually, Brexit is what we need to fight if we want to fight the far right.
Yep.
They are the same thing. And you see the whole, you know, the love socialism, hate Brexit configuration of MPs who are all of whom, you know, they're Corbyn-supporting MPs. They want a Corbyn-led government. But also, you know, when you see it reflected in the grassroots as well.
Momentum were one of the bodies that wrote into the NEC saying we want you to support unequivocally a sort of confirmatory referendum, weren't they?
Well, I think... I'm not sure. I think there are divisions within Momentum well. But certainly, you know, reading between the lines of their own internal polling of where their members are at, it would seem that their members mostly think Brexit would be incredibly damaging, but also support some kind of second vote on whatever deal.
There were lots of people missing from the NEC yesterday, as I understand it. I think there were about 10 of them who weren't there. I don't know if you know what the breakdown was of that. I mean, presumably some had sort of personal reasons for not being able to go. I just wonder whether there was any kind of, you know, people that just didn't want to have to make the decision and sat it out.
I'm sure there's lots of people who didn't have to. None of us want to have to make any of these decisions. But I think that the problem, I don't really know, but I think the problem with this issue and the danger of this issue is that, you know, there's this tendency to inside Labour to cast it as a factional issue. And that is to its detriment. Other issues also fall into this camp where you really don't want people to be factional about it. And I'm saying this about the left and the right of the party.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, once Tom Watson became, you know, the envoy for that message of, listen, we need a second We need a confirmatory vote on any deal. We just need that at this stage in the game. Once he became the envoy for that, I think it was really unfortunate that he did, because it then meant...
It became a Trojan horse for getting Corbyn.
Exactly, yeah. And that's the suspicion all along. That's been the suspicion all along. So I do think that was, you know, that didn't help. But I also, you know, neither side has been able to get above that factionalism.
Well, you wrote about going to the Put It to the People march and the contrast between the left bloc, who I think their kind of mini rally was where we set off on Park Lane. So we heard some of those speeches, comparing them with this what you call the centrist status quo. I mean, the people's vote, and I suppose Remain generally, is, you know, dominated certainly on the kind of upper level by these sort of what you might call centrist figures. But do you think that Labour's ambiguity, despite the work of people like Clive Lewis, made that inevitable, that if you're taking out of the fight instantly the kind of top flight of, you know, taking out the Labour leadership and the shadow cabinet, how else could it have played out? I mean, surely it was bound to take a more sort of centrist turn if Labour was cautious.
You know what? I do think there's an element of that, of you can't have it both ways. You can't both criticise the people's vote for being status quo, continuity, the worst advocates for a second vote, and at the same time not engage. The way to make people's vote nothing like the people's vote is to have the Labour left leading it. So I don't think you can have it both ways in that argument. But I also think that the Remain, you know, that continuity Remain element has really done so little to engage with the reality of Brexit and what made people vote for it, and also the part that they had to play in it.
Yeah.
So when you look at some of the leading lights of the people's vote, you know, they are people who were part of that neoliberal consensus, whether it was from the left or the right, that has created these awful wealth gaps in the UK, that has created communities that feel decimated and neglected and disconnected, that has caused a situation where migrants have been allowed to be scapegoated for economic failures which they are not responsible for. You know, there was
that
a point
ignored
when
a million people marching against Iraq.
Right. So there's something there about the people's vote people that is very disengaged from the actual nuts and bolts of what it would take to bring people with them on that journey. And that, you know, if you voted Remain, that is very frustrating to watch.
And you wrote another piece for The Guardian, good newspaper, about the sort of how the pushback from Labour MPs and sort of high-profile Corbyn supporters like Erin Jones and Ash Sarkar prompted a very swift Labour U-turn on the Conservative immigration bill. There was huge sort of uproar, and they changed position very quickly. Why do you think pressure worked so quickly on that occasion and not on sort of broader issues such as freedom of movement or the referendum or whatever? What was it about that suddenly made it so... that made it so effective?
That's a really good question. I think because it was so unequivocal and it was across the board. So the names you just mentioned, for instance, wouldn't necessarily be...
In the same camp.
A confirmatory vote. But I do think that's a really interesting question. So I remember talking to Momentum, someone from Momentum, just after the second leadership election. So Jeremy Corbyn, when he sort of had his leadership challenged and retained it. And, you know, I was saying, look, as a Corbyn-supporting grassroots movement, I get it. Like, you're going to defend the leadership when the leadership is imperiled. You know, you're going to defend it in terms of that's what the party members want. And that is your role. Once his leadership is secured, what do you then become? Are you a group that is always loyal to the leadership no matter what? Or what are you loyal to? Are you loyal to radical politics? So are you loyal to the principles of freedom of movement, climate change, airport
expansion? The person itself, what
is it that you will challenge the left on? And I see this as, it's not even to do with it being the Corbyn left, it's just how politics works. You know, parties, when they get powerful, become centralised, they're detached from their grassroots. And so how are you going to keep them to account, especially when you're dealing with a left-wing party that has proclaimed, and a left-wing leadership that's proclaimed that it is in a relationship with its grassroots, that it is grassroots-led, that it believes in participatory democracy. If you have that kind of relationship,
not on Brexit,
what will you use it for?
On other
and that's
issues,
been the question.
On other issues, it's grassroots-led, and that was my final disappointment, I'm afraid. It's just so patently clear which way the grassroots of the party want to go on the issue of a confirmatory vote, that it's just nonsensical to resist it and still maintain that you're democratizing the party and you're going to be led on policy issues from the grassroots.
And its voters, it's not even just its grassroots, but I mean, Labour is polling incredibly badly in Scotland at the moment. And I think the point that isn't made firmly enough from within Labour to Jeremy Corbyn is this whole issue of Scotland. If we Brexit, the chances of independence in Scotland become much, 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 much more likely. Yeah. And I don't think that Labour can win a majority government on seats in England and Wales alone. And if it wasn't for Scotland, it wouldn't have won in 2005, for instance. So the prospect of Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister is unfathomable, I think, if they can't rely on votes in Scotland.
But I do think that that's the bit where, you know, the Corbyn brand, which has been about, you know, he's honesty,
authentic,
the credibility, the authenticity.
He's been damaged in the long term.
I think
by
that this has damaged his brand, or risks damaging his brand, because it's like, either you believe in party democracy, in which case you really, you know, overwhelmingly, the party is telling you to go in a particular direction.
It's doing badly in North London as well, not just north of England. And I hear that Diane's seat and Jeremy's seat are both not, you know, nowhere near where they were, which is in part why Emily Thornberry has parked her tanks slightly more on Corbyn's lawn on the issue of Brexit in the last few months as well, because their canvas returns are not good.
Interesting times.
How confident do you feel about, if there was a general election, which of course seems to be Labour's priority, about getting the a result that you would like? What sort of fighting state are they in?
Yeah, I have two concerns chiefly about that. One is that I don't know to what extent this whole issue around Brexit has demoralised Labour's ground game. It needs that ground game. It needs all those activists to go out, you know, not just on the doorstep, but in communities, in offices, and talk the Labour talk, right? That's a massive tool that it has. It's a massive asset, half a million members. And then the second thing that worries me is, if you are the Labour Party and you have this radical, socioeconomic transformation plan, you need a majority for that. You don't just need to scrape through. To have a mandate for some pretty big change and to be able to hold on to the mandate for that change, I think that you need a pretty clear majority. And that worries me as well, the capacity to actually bring in a resounding win that says, absolutely, clear cut, we can implement this policy over the next 4 years.
And not have every piece of legislation picked over.
Exactly.
No, you're right. He needs a sort of a kind of landslide, really.
And you've also written very well about anti-Semitism, which has obviously been a kind of long, rolling problem for Labour. And to sort of get away from Corbyn as an individual, what do you think is the sort of the root of anti-Semitism on the left specifically? Because, I mean, there's obviously Israel-Palestine, you know, and the tensions around that plays a huge part. But there also seems to be this 200-year-old obsession with the Rothschilds and this conspiracist view of capitalism as a sort of, as a sort of conspiracy. And do you think that, because I think for many years, I think many people on the left have associated anti-Semitism with the right and is very good at doing that, you know, fighting them in the streets and opposing them in Parliament, etc. Do you feel that it's going to take quite a while, quite apart from the personal politics of this, for sort of the left to understand what left-wing anti-Semitism is and how to sort of recognise and deal with it?
It probably will take a while, but on the other hand, it has been there for a while. You know, it didn't start with the Corbyn leadership. It was always there on the fringe. And I do think that this is another example of the problem you have when you see everything through a factional lens. Mm. So because it's been, I think there is an element of the left that sees this as a factional stick with which to beat Corbyn, and then there's a fairly reflexive, defensive response to that, yeah. which is completely unhelpful if you're trying to tackle prejudice.
Yeah,
and
it's understandable, but
and also that the membership has been conditioned over several years to react in a defensive way. Mm. So, you know, the fact that the leadership was, you know, ridiculed for so long, you know, these ridiculous stories, checks by, et cetera, didn't bow enough at the cenotaph. All that stuff. And to a certain extent, there are elements of the leadership that has, you know, not exactly tried to do anything different, you know, so that has been quite useful to them as well. But it's resulted in a dynamic where there's a very defensive and unexamined reaction to anti-Semitism. But I do think that the two delivery mechanisms that you speak of are the main drivers of it on the left. There is the critique of economic power structures that is valid, and it's a socialist left critique. The terminology can become infected, mm-hmm. right, with some pretty bad anti-Semitic tropes. And so, you know, there's a need, and I think that's been around for a while as well. You know, people talk about it being around during the Occupy movement. Mm. So there's been that strain of it. And the other strain of it is, you know, the Israel-Palestine conflict, where completely valid and legitimate criticisms of Israel slide into language that is very hostile to Jewish people. So those are the two delivery mechanisms. And I think the reason it's particularly resilient in the left is because the left doesn't self-identify as racist and therefore has a...
yeah, the reaction is, we're the good guys.
Instead of going, racism is like prejudice is an animating force that exists in society and everybody is at some point susceptible, right?
Yeah.
That's how prejudice works. Yeah. It's always in society at large. So that's what's made the left have a bit of a blind spot over this issue, which has made it very difficult to raise and to engage with.
Well, actually, sort of to tie things together, I suppose it you know, reminds me of what you're saying about how important it would be for this sort of Corbyn project to have a majority, because I think what you're suggesting, I think, is right, is that the more embattled Corbyn corporate supporters become, almost sort of the worse their judgment, and that I would worry about sort of minority government where it was, and they'd also had a lot of press against them as well, we'd be in that constant siege mentality and perhaps would not make the same decisions that it would make if it felt in a more comfortable position. Mm. So it would be less defensive, right, if it had a majority.
You would hope. I don't know to what...
Maybe I'm being more optimistic than you.
I don't know to what extent, because when we saw... So the 2017 general election, in which, you know, Labour did so much better than anyone expected, and the left was proved right that if you tack left on a socioeconomic programme, you will have popular support for it. And that was the point at which you would expect the Labour Party to expand, or the Labour left to expand, right? Bring in different factions who kind of went... Yeah, you were right. That's the time to bring them in.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that's happened. I wonder if the opposite has happened, like there has actually been more of a retreat, which I don't think has been that helpful.
This is what happens every time I try optimism.
It's
thrown back in my
but
face.
No, you're right.
It's an interesting parallel, I think, also with Brexit, that both the Brexit side and Labour left, they didn't quite know when they had won, and it was time to be gracious to the vanquished and find a compromise. They kept pushing as if they were still losing.
Well, the end of the show is here, and that means something else, the Brexit time capsule. Rachel Shabby, what are you placing in our underground cache of stuff we'll need if we leave the EU? I'm deleting when. If.
Okay. Your audience is going to think this is so precious. So I'm going to put a warning on it. I'm going to miss, you know, I'm someone with a very hyphenated identity, and I'm going to miss that capacity to be hyphenated. Now, I know leavers say, it doesn't mean we're leaving Europe, we're still part of Europe, but I think that we will lose that hyphenation, being British and European, and I will miss the capacity for hyphenation.
Thanks. And we've got another German clip to close the show. This is Rebecca Dell. Sorry. I don't think her name has a question mark in it. We've got another German clip to close the show. This is Rebecca Dell, who is an ex-Erasmus student who moved back to Berlin right after the Brexit vote. This is really short, so listen closely.
Halt die Fresse, die EU ist besser.
That basically means, shut up, the EU is better, which is very German. Send us your European language clips at info@romaniacs.com. We'll use the best ones. That's the end of the show. Rachel Shabby, thanks for coming in. What are you working on at the moment?
I do quite a lot about racism and immigration, so those are got a few pieces I'm working on around those issues.
Yeah, unfortunately, too much material at the moment.
Quite a lot.
Now, here's our theme tune, Demon is a Monster, and a salute to some of our latest Patreon backers.
A heartfelt Evharistopoli from me to Yossi Emolaya, Andrew Cummings, Marshall Matthews, Graham Johnson, Colm Prunty, John Sparaga, Dean Browning, Julian Mattox, Anne Cheng, and Ian Craggs.
Hello to Bar Lerpman, David Walter, Brian Power, Emma Smith, Justin Brame, Lucy Kimball, Helen Taylor-Wilkinson, Juliet Finney, Adrian Macias, and Nicola Sanders.
And thanks for me to Owen Hunt, Martin Ford Downs, Tim Hughes, Sue Harvey, Janine Nicol, Simon Malinitz, QC, Amanda Little, Mark Ravenet, Roger, and Rebecca. See you next time.
Romaniacs is presented by Dorian Linsky with Naomi Smith and Alex Andreo. The producer is me, Andrew Harrison, and audio production was by Sophie Black. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.